I think it's a tradition for this N1 workshop that for 2 evenings that I have two postdocs, right, mostly, and I'm giving a long talk and about the story, a full story of the biological system, and then a full story. And so tonight is Min-Nei Zhao from Axel Brunner Lab, and giving the talk about the structure study of AADPase, basically it's an NSF complex. And Min-Nei is an X-ray crystallographer by training, and he got his PhD from UCLA in David Eisenhoff lab. And now he's a postdoc in Axel Brunner Lab, and which is also a crystallographer lab. But he also worked with our lab and then on the cryo-EM. And in this project, he worked with Shenping Wu in our lab, and then together to using the cryo-EM and then get a structure. And then he will tell you the whole story, which I think is a fabulous story. And then he is also a good example that how we cryo-EM field converted a crystallographer into the cryo-EM field. So I hope you will enjoy his story.
Okay, so can you hear me? Okay, good evening. So I'm very glad to give a talk here. First, I would like to thank Yifan and the organizer, Clint, for giving me this opportunity to talk about my projects. And I do think I am more a crystallographer than a microscopist still. So, but again, I'm going to present the cryo-EM data. Hope you enjoy it. Okay, let's see. Huh? Oh, remote is not working. Okay, so I was thinking very hard to come out an outline, but I gave up. Instead, just like many people did, I gave this sentence. So this talk will highlight the biology while also drawing attention to the technical advances that made it possible. So first I will talk about biology. I'll talk about this triple ATPase, how we got the cryo-EM structures, and what's the biological significance of that. Then I will spend one or two slides try to draw your attention about the technical advances. Mostly I will try to compare, based on my own experience, crystallography and single particle cryo-EM. So what are the current stage of these two techniques? All right, let me start with this slide. This is, pretty old. Last year, the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine was awarded to these three gentlemen, James Rothman, Randy Shechtman, and Tom Tsuloff. So this is the statement for their discoveries of machinery regulating vesicle traffic, a major transport system in our cells. So the protein I'm studying is involved in vesicle traffic. And most of the part of the vesicle traffic is related to the protein called SNARE. So it's SNARE-mediated vesicle membrane fusion. Basically, this is a simplified model. So for a membrane fusion system, you have these proteins, they call the SNARE proteins, which upon docking, so they will zip together to form coil to coil, and upon membrane fusion, these proteins will form a 4 alpha helix bundle complex. This is called SNARE complex. And the forming of this coil to coil, the free energy of forming this coil to coil complex will drive the fusion of provide the energy of this membrane fusion. Okay, so this is a simplified view, and actually SNARE proteins are involved in many fusion systems in our eukaryotic cells. So we all know that eukaryotic cells, they have lots of different compartments, and you have vesicles trafficking from, for example, ER to Golgi, from Golgi to endosome, from Golgi to plasma membrane, and all these steps involve membrane fusion. And there are different kinds of SNARE proteins involved. Either 3 proteins or 4 proteins are involved. But nevertheless, they all form a 4 alpha helix bundle. So if there are 3 proteins involved, then one protein needs to provide 2 alpha helix domains for it to form a 4 alpha helix bundle upon membrane fusion. Here is another more specific example, so SNARE-mediated neurotransmitter release. So this is a typical chemical synapse. And on the top is a presynaptic neuron, and at the bottom is postsynaptic neuron. And upon action potential triggering the influx of calcium, then you have these called synaptic vesicles, about 40 nanometer in diameter, loaded with neurotransmitter. They will fuse and release these neurotransmitters to the postsynaptic neuron. And this step is also involved in those SNARE proteins. Okay, here is a more detailed view about this process. So this is the target membrane, which contains 2 SNARE proteins called syntaxin and SNAP25. You don't need to remember the name, but remember these 2 proteins are SNARE proteins. And then this target membrane is the plasma membrane of presynaptic neuron. Upon docking with these synaptic vesicles, again about 40 nanometer in diameter, then these vesicles contain a neurotransmitter and another SNARE protein called synaptogravin in this case. So upon docking, it will form this complex. But this complex is not fully folded yet. It is not fully zipped yet. This is a half-zipped complex, which is called trans-SNARE complex, because the complex, it juxtaposes the 2 membranes. And then upon calcium influx, and also many proteins, many other proteins are involved, within 1 millisecond, actually, this process happens. These proteins, they zipper, form the 4 half helix bundle, and then release the neurotransmitter to the postsynaptic neuron. And now this complex is on the same, it's on one continuous membrane, so it's called cis-SNARE complex. And then here comes our player. There is a dedicated triple ATPase called N-ethylmalamide sensitive factor, stands for NSF, which hydrolyzes ATP and disassembles this cis-SNARE complex. This SNAP is the adapter protein, which is absolutely required for this disassembly. And then these SNARE proteins can be, this is called disassembly, these SNARE proteins can be recycled. So this is a full cycle of synaptic vesicle fusion. Okay, so if you take a holistic view, actually, like I told you, the membrane fusion itself does not cause any ATP. The ATP actually comes from here, from disassembling this complex. Like I said, forming of this complex provides the free energy that drives the fusion of the membrane, but the actual energy is actually coming from this step, coming from the ATP over here. And this is this is biology, oversimplified view. So there are lots of proteins actually involved in MONK 18, MONK 13. So Tom Sulov got Nobel Prize because he found 2 machineries, MONK 18 and synaptagmin, involved in this process. And again, NSF and the SNAP and ATP may have some role in this step to disassemble some non-productive SNARE complex. So anyway, you now have the idea. NSF is a dedicated triple ATPase, hydrolyze ATP, disassemble SNARE complex. Okay, so now more about our player, the NSF protein. It was first purified in 1988 by Jim Rothman. So Jim Rothman got Nobel Prize. And it is one of the first, actually it is the first identified machinery involved in vesicle traffic. And it was also, it also came out in Randy Sheckman's famous East screen. If you know that screen, it is those SEC mutants. This is one of the SEC mutants. This is SEC 18, actually, is exactly this enzyme. And then it belongs to triple ATPase superfamily. It is a homomeric hexamer, about half megadalton. It is very conserved in eukaryotes. So here I'm talking about the sequence identity. So from East Baker's East, which is SEC 18, it's about 46-50% identity to human sequence. And then in mammals, it's basically 99% conserved. So unfortunately, there is not any diseases associated with this protein because it's too important. You can't afford any mutations. But anyway, this is an important protein, and we are really interested to understand the mechanism involving that. And here is a little bit of history. So the protein is 744 amino acids long, contains basically three domains, N domain, D1, and D2 domain. D1 and D2 are two ATPase domains. So it is a triple ATPase that has two ATPase rings. And the crystal structures of N domain and D2 domains are available a long time ago, actually. Now, more than 15 years ago, actually. This is the crystal structure of the N domain. It is a kidney shape, published, solved actually from Exo's lab in 1999. Crystal structure of the D2 domain is a beautiful hexagon, you can see, and also solved about more than 15 years ago from Exo's lab, also Bill Wise's lab. So people have done a lot of biochemical characterization of this enzyme. They found that the D2 domain, while it is an ATPase domain, but it is mainly used as an oligomerization domain. So without nucleotide, this D2 domain will not form a hexamer. But with nucleotide, it will form a hexamer. The ATPase activity is very low for this domain, though. The N domain is the domain that's involved in adaptor protein and the substrate binding. And D1 domain is the actual domain that actually hydrolyze ATP and do the work. But up to now, the crystal structure of D1 domain is still missing. So there is no crystal structure of the D1 domain, although it's just a soluble ATPase domain, which is considered by many people to be easy to crystallize. But this one, the structure is not available. And here are some other players. This is the adaptor protein called SNAP. It actually comes from NSF. So the soluble NSF attachment protein, this is called SNAP. This is the adapter protein. So the adapter protein is basically an alpha helical protein. It has, this was the crystal structure also solved by Exo long time ago. It's yeast homolog sec 17. This is also coming from the same yeast screen. And this snare, actually, it stands for soluble NSF attachment protein receptor, which is a quite long name. But the crystal structure, this is a famous crystal structure, which contains, like I mentioned, four alpha helix bundles coiled together. So upon membrane fusion, remember these snare proteins, they are on different membranes, then they zipper to form this complex to drive the fusion of the membrane. And then what NSF does is hydrolyze ATP, disassemble this very stable 4 alpha helix bundle, and then these proteins can be recycled for the next round of fusion. And EM structures was actually, EM studies was carried out for this NSF. There were two studies I want to mention. This one was actually done more than 10 years ago, also from Exo's lab in collaboration with Nicole. We tried to get the cryo-EM structure of the whole complex, the NSF, with adapter protein and the substrate. But at that time, the sample quality is not good enough to see a lot of features. And this is a more recent work published 2 years ago from Sui Group at Tsinghua University, where they actually got two states. So the NSF bind to two different nucleotide states. One is aluminum fluoride derivative, the other one is ADP state. So the density map is still not of sufficient quality to build a model for the D1 domain, but there is a message from this study that you can see this top layer, which is supposed to be the N domain. Upon ATP hydrolysis, it seems the N domain comes to the side of the ATPase ring. This is the message from this paper. Other than that, the D2 domain, you can be relatively well docked, and the resolution of this map is higher than this one. This one is about 11 or 13 angstrom. This one is about 9.5 angstrom, as claimed at that time. But still, we need to know more details. And as I told you, as Yifan told you, I was a crystallographer. I am a crystallographer. And I started this project by crystallizing NSF. This is the crystal I got for NSF. So looking at that now, the only thing I can say is that means my protein is quite pure. So you can crystallize that. Then this is the first shot of crystal diffraction we got about 8 angstrom. This is even not a crystal diffraction pattern. It looks like a fiber diffraction pattern. So you see these streaks, 8 angstrom. But it's still good for a crystallographer for a first shot, you see. Then after hundreds and hundreds of crystal screening at APS, this is the best shot got. So we actually collect the data set from that, 9.3 angstrom. So you can see now, you can see like these individual spots, diffraction spots. We can determine the space group, we can, well, but what you can do for this 9.3 angstrom data, we have to keep working, right? Then, so as crystallographers, we never give up. So we use another beam, which is very, it's been mentioned a lot, like these days, called a free electron laser. So since we are at Stanford, so we are sort of relatively close to that beam, we try to sneak in to shoot our crystals. This is at the CXI station, where they publish a paper. You can see they use an injector. Basically, they inject these tiny crystals into the vacuum and then use free electron laser to shoot it. So I have to break my nice-looking needle-like NSF crystals into these small crystals so that to put into their injector. The scale bar here is 200 micrometers, so you can see, you can barely see some crystals, but I provide the crystal slurry, which I provide about 500 microliter crystals. That's considered to be a lot, actually, for a crystallographer. 500 microliter crystals, they put into the injector, last for like about 2 hours, and then from tens of thousands of diffraction images, they found this one. Diffraction pattern at 8 angstrom. Still at 8 angstrom, so it's quite disappointing. Again, we keep trying. So there is a X-ray free action laser station, another station which is under development by Michael Sotis at Stanford University. He is trying to put the SPIX goniometer. So it's like a traditional synchrotron, but use a free electron laser beam. So now you can actually mount the crystal, and then you can shoot it like we did at synchrotron. Still, the diffraction pattern is 8 angstrom. But I have to say that in this case, we don't have the luxury to screening like hundreds of crystals, because the beam time at X-ray free electron laser is like every few hours, half a year. So it's quite precious beam time. But still, you can see we don't see much improvement of the diffraction pattern. And in case if you wonder how this looks like after the free electron laser, it's like this. So you see these dark spots? So each spot is a shot. So basically you shoot it and then you damage it. This is still not the fully focused beam. This is about 10 micron beam. So you shoot it, you will have this black hole. If you use a fully focused beam, then everything is blasted away, including the loop. So the loop, and now it becomes like one-time use. You have to shoot it and throw it away. So laser is strong enough, but again, if you don't have good diffracting crystals, then you cannot do much about that. Okay, now comes, so I'm lucky to have, to collaborate with Yifan and Shen Ping. So we actually started. We actually started with another project, but as they were training me how to use the microscope, so even when they told me, like, why don't you just test your own samples instead of ferritin? Well, ferritin is boring. So, okay, I just bring my sample, and it looks like this. So, actually, it looked like this after several months of optimization. Okay. This is a K2 camera image after motion correction. So you can see these individual particles actually quite nicely, but we did had quite a lot of problems. We have to deal with the orientation preference. We screen quite a lot of conditions to get to this stage. So as you have heard probably this morning, triple ATPase, they have some, they tend to form like end-zone views in these cryo grids. So you have to screen some conditions so that they sit side views nicely in these vitreous eyes. And here is the 2D classic. Oh, for this particular case, well, I don't want to claim so it will work in every case because every case is different. For me, it's like finding a good crystallization conditions. So it's basically like that. You have to try a lot of conditions. This what one word? With yeah. Detergent. Word? Detergent. With
EDM?
A little. No.
MP40?
Oh, yes. Good guess. Yeah, this one is. But I want to say, I don't want to advertise on NP40. Yeah. You can try, we did try like beta OG, DDM, all these different detergents. So you have to try, give it a lot of try. And you have to try different concentrations. Basically, to me, it's like, that I forget. You can check our paper, it's get published. Yeah, you can check.
Just tell us. Why don't you just tell us? What do you mean, check the paper?
He said, whoa, I can't tell the exact number, it's in the paper, but it's low concentration, right? 0.5% or?
Half CMC.
I don't know what's the CMC of MP40? There are lots of detergents to test. Anyway, this is like a crystallization. Okay, so this is a 2D class average. You can see nice features out of these 2D class averages. And it's quite pleasing for me to see that. Then this is the slice views of the final reconstruction. And like I said, the D1 domain, the D2 domain, you can see the D2 domain. This is sliced through. You can see quite nice alpha helices. And it's very beautiful hexagons. But for D1 domain, we do have some fuzzy features over there. And here is the angle distribution. So we did manage to find this condition with MP40. You can sample, most of them are side views. As you can see, this is a projection. And some of them we still have some end-on views, but most of them are side views. This is critical to get a reconstruction. And here is the Fourier shell correlation, where we use a gold standard refinement to determine the resolution to be around 4.2 angstrom. And here is the map of the ATP state. So this is the NSF in ATP state. On the left side, you are seeing four views with sharpened map. Basically, you don't see any end domains. On the right side, you are looking at unsharpened map with displayed at a lower contour level. And that only by then you can see these fuzzy end domains. So that is probably probably the factor that caused the crystal like diffract to only 8 angstrom or so, because this layer is actually not very well ordered. Nevertheless, from this layer, you can actually see there are 6 end domains. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There is one very special near the center. I'll talk more about this later. But again, if you look at the bottom, so this is a hexagon. This is a D2 domain, which has a crystal structure too. It's a hexagon crystal structure. The D1 domain is not like that. You see, one domain is actually not very well ordered. At this contour level, there is one D1 domain that is missing. And then the gold chain, this yellow represent one chain, one single polypeptide chain. It's a homomeric hexamer. So this is a single polypeptide chain from here to here and then up to the end domain over there. Okay, so structural features about ATP-bound NSF. On the left side, this is at 4.2 angstrom, you can see these alpha helix, you can see very nice grooves and some, well, little density for this bulky side chains. And also for this beta strand, you can see these C alpha atoms, they are about 3.8 angstrom apart. And the beta sheet is resolved quite nicely. Actually, to resolve this, you have to have a resolution better than 4.8 or 4.7 angstrom. Then you will be able to see individual beta strands within a sheet. And it, like I said, this is a typical ATPase domain. So if you are familiar with ATPase domain, you know all these elements, the worker sequence and the sensor region of this P loop containing ATPase. And we do, not in all the chains, but for 3 out of 6 chains, we are able to see the linker density pretty well, connecting the D1 domain and the D2 domain. And we were able to build a model de novo from the density of the D1 domain. So this did took a while because the density is like 4.2 angstrom. So I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but it took me about 2 weeks to build the whole model. It's actually not a very easy task. Even for crystallographer, I mean, for crystallography at 4.2 angstrom, if you try to build a model from electron density, it's not an easy job to do that. We do have some tools, as I will mention later. So the D1 domain actually has 2 subdomains. One is containing 4 alpha helixes called alpha subdomain. And this larger part on the right side is called alpha beta subdomain. And ATP is binding sort of in between these 2 subdomains. Okay, and here is the movie. So you can see the structure in 3-dimensional. So the D2 domain form at the bottom, the D1 domain is at the middle. Here is contoured at a lower level, so it's a little bit noisy, ugly-looking density, but still you can rigid body dock these N-domain crystal structures into the density. But for the bottom part, for the ATPase part, we can actually refine the structure into the density. We can put the crystal structure into that and refine it for the D2, and we can build the D1 model out of the density. And I hope you can see that the D1 ring is not flat. It's actually helical. It's actually helical. So it's not like the D2 ring is a perfect hexagon. The D1 ring is actually helical. And that's an asymmetric feature we found. So starting from the bottom, a perfect 6-fold symmetry, to the top, there is a break of the symmetry. The top layer is not symmetrical at all, and the center layer is sort of helical. We call it split worship, as you will see. So here is the full model of the ATP bound NSF. So like I said, the ATPase domain is like a split washer. It's a right-handed split washer, which is not available actually in daily life. Daily life, it's all left-handed. This is a right-handed split washer on top of a D2 ring, a flat D2 ring. We actually rainbow color these chains. So from red is the chain that's closest to the D2 ring, and the purple is the chain on the top of the split washer. Then if you unroll these ATPase rings and you can align them, if you align based on the D2 domain, because it's sort of a flat ring, then you can see the step. You can see the step between each chain. Here I use a dotted box to outline the alpha 2 helices. So you can see relatively about 5 angstrom rising between each chain. And this chain, the chain F, the purple chain, is actually special. It's a bridge. The bridge is from the top, from the highest blue chain to the lowest red chain. And here is the density for all these D1 domains. We are looking at the nucleotide binding pocket. So we can clearly see nucleotides binding at 5 out of 6 D1 domains. This one, like the purple chain, is special. Well, the density is not very well resolved, so we don't see any nucleotide binding there. But again, we think there should not be any nucleotide binding because it's adopting a different conformation. Here is what I just meant. So if you superimpose these structures based on the large subdomain, the alpha beta subdomain, then you can see this purple chain is different from the others. It's because it's a bridge. The bridge is from the top to the bottom, so it's adopting a different conformation. Okay, so that's all about the That's all about the ATP state. Then we try the same thing for the ADP bound NSF. And this micrograph is not as good as the previous one. We did try very hard to try to get a better one, but we ended up with this one. Still, in 2D class average, you can see some nice features over here. And at the bottom row here, I'm showing a focused 2D class average. Because from previous study, we know that the N-domain might fold down at the ADP state. So we did focus the 2D class average, and we did see some density come out. Yes. Yes, that's a leopard skin. But we don't know how to get rid of that in this case. We did try quite a few different functions. Any ideas? I would like to know. Yeah. This is the final reconstruction, the slice view of the final reconstruction. And now the D2 domain, as you can see from here, it's not a perfect hexagon anymore. And the D1 domain, it's even more severe. It's an open ring, as I will show you more details later. Here is the 3D, here is the angle distribution. This time we didn't collect, data collection for this ADP bound state is more difficult. So the particle density is simply not as high as the ATP bound state. And the particles tend to stick onto the edge of the grid. So we have to image a lot more. But we ended up with actually less particles in this case compared to the ATP bound state. And the reconstruction went all the way to 7.6 angstrom. Again, the map is not high resolution, atomic resolution, but still it's nice to see all these features coming out. You can see these secondary structure features. The yellow density corresponds to one single chain. And then at a lower contour level for unsharpened map, we can see these end domains. The surprising thing is two of the six end domains actually folded up. So I need to mention that during reconstruction, we didn't impose any symmetry because many people think that triple ATPAs are six-fold. Well, it's a homomeric hexamer, but sometimes it's worth considering that not imposing symmetry will probably give you something, will probably reveal some asymmetrical features. And like I said, the D1 ring is actually open in this case, as pointed by this black arrow. It's quite a surprising feature. Here is, again, a three-dimensional view of the model and the map. So the D2 ring is flat. The D1 ring is not as helical as the ATP bound state. But the surprising feature is it's open. And then there are two end domains, actually. The density of these two end domains are relatively resolved better than the densities on the top. So these are for this ADP bound state. Again, we can distinguish each chain because it's not symmetrical. So from red to purple, we can rainbow color these chains. Here is a full model of ADP bound NSF. It's still forming layers, but again, two of the end domains flipped down along the side of these ATPase rings. Now it represents an open flat washer. So it's not a right-handed split washer anymore. It's an open flat washer on top of a D2 ring. So what does that mean? First, let's unroll these ATPase domains and align them. Now you can see it's not a helical arrangement anymore, sort of on one plane, although this red chain, this chain A, is a little bit higher than all the others. So now we have two states, the enzyme at two states. We can compare them layer by layer. So this is the D2 domains, the D2 domains of ATP bound NSF, this is very close to the crystal structure. We can dock into the crystal structure and it fits almost perfectly. By the way, this is not EM density, this is surface representation. So we calculated the interface between these domains, and you can see these are calculated interfaces using the program called PISA. I don't know how many of you use that. This is the ADP state. Actually, there is one interface that's decreased a lot, you can see, upon ATP hydrolysis. So this is, we think this is caused by the large opening of the D1 domain. So even so, caused by that, D2 ring is not symmetrical. And this is the look at the D1 ring. Like I said, this is a split washer, right-handed split washer. This purple chain bridge up from the top to the bottom. This is the D2 ring based on the model. It's widely open. It's open so that you can almost put another ATPase domain into that. This is actually a very interesting feature, because if you look at the crystal structure of some ATP, triple ATPase, some of them we know they are hexamer, but if you crystallize a single domain, at least there are two cases I know, you crystallize a heptamer instead of a hexamer. So, well, if you want to pack some a domain into a crystal, it's difficult to crystallize open ring, right? So probably that suggests in many other triple ATPase, you may have this sort of ring opening associated with the enzyme. And this is the N-domain. The N-domain is not very well resolved. So, but again, we can dock these N-domains into the density. This N-domain from ATP bond structure is at the center. It's sort of special because I showed you that we think the reason is because this ATPase domain, it's sort of special. It's bridged from top to the bottom. Like I showed you the superposition. This one is special. So probably that will affect the N-domain associated with a link to this D1 domain. And this ADP bound state, two of the N domains, they fold down. So now we can draw some conclusions from these two, based on these two structures. So you have, we have seen upon ATP hydrolysis, a slight open of the D2 ring, a wide open of the D1 ring, and a flipping down of the two N domains. Then the question is, so how this is coupled with ATP hydrolysis? So how come you hydrolyze ATP and cause such dramatic conformational change? So we try to answer this. We cannot fully address this yet, but we try to answer this by superposing the on the left, I already showed you that this is ATP state. We superpose based on the alpha beta, the subdomain here, and then you can see the alpha 7, the purple chain is sort of different. If you superimpose ADP bond state, the D1 ring, based on the alpha beta subdomain, then you can see they actually superimpose quite well. They overlap quite well. Now, if we exclude this purple chain, we compare before and after ATP hydrolysis, what happened between this and this? Here is the superposition, still based on the alpha beta subdomain. Gray ones are five D1 domain from ATP bond state, and the white ones are six states from ADP bond state. So you can see the change, the relative motion is this called alpha 7 helix. There is a translation of this alpha 7 helix based on the ATP and ADP state based on comparison. So this translation from this gray to this white helix will cause this helix actually sort of insert into the ATP or the nucleotide binding pocket here. So we do think like upon ATP hydrolysis, you have this translation of alpha 7 helices. So the ADP molecule, we didn't see any ADP molecules here in our ADP state. So we did think like upon ATP hydrolysis, you have this translation and then the nucleotide is just cannot binding to the pocket anymore. So upon ATP hydrolysis, you have this translation. And by accumulating this translation, it's like a spring being released. So this is another view, like I showed you before, but it's viewing from the top. So the white shadow are D2 domains. They are all aligned. And you are just looking at these colorful D1 domains. You can see the relative, this is ATP bound state. So the relative position of D1 to D2 are about the same, but upon ATP hydrolysis, in the ADP state, you can see this red chain. This red chain has a very dramatic outward movement. It's actually rotated out. So it's almost like a loaded spring. When you hydrolyze ATP, it's released. So now this this ring is open. This is a split, a closed split washer. This is open flat washer. And then here is a movie made by Shenping, a morph movie. So hope you can appreciate the, well, this is a morph movie, everybody knows. The states in between is not scientific. But again, you can see like upon ATP hydrolysis, there are only two endomains shown. The D1 ring opens and the D2 ring slightly open. The D1 ring from a split washer to an open washer, and then the two endomains flip down. This is related to the function of the enzyme. So how this enzyme binds to substrate and hydrolyze, bond to the substrate and disassemble snare complex. So for the time being, this will be the last structure I'm going to show you. For the interest of this talk, I said I'm going to like compare based on my personal experience, single particle cryo EM versus X-ray crystallography. Okay, so this is my personal experience. What about these two techniques? Well, sample preparation. For X-ray, we need crystals. For cryo EM, well, as Yifan showed yesterday, monodisperse size exclusion profile is necessary but not sufficient. Well, what is sufficient? I would recommend if you have some crystals, but doesn't diffract very well, in my case, that would be a pretty relatively good sample for cryo EM. There are lots of cases like this, I think. There are lots of, especially for membrane proteins, some proteins diffract to like 6 angstrom. So what are you going to do with this 6 angstrom diffraction data? These might be the good targets for single particle cryo EM. Well, the fact that you got crystals means your proteins are quite pure. Data collection. So cryo EM, Shenping told me we do have a remote, but I don't think it's why. At least at UCSF, we manually collect the data. For synchrotron, we know that most data collection nowadays are remote. So you send a sample, you collect the data remotely. And for data collection, cryo EM took about 1 to 2 days for one data set. For X-ray, it's pretty fast, actually. Nowadays, with the new Plettus detector, one data set is about 10 minutes. Although, if you have some radiation damage or radiation-sensitive crystals, that will take a little bit longer. But compared to cryo EM, it's relatively efficient. For X-ray crystallography, well, if we have a crystal, we collect data. The crystal has symmetry, but at most, we need to collect 360-degree data in the real space. But this is the thing I want to draw your attention. So I don't think there is an answer yet. How much is enough? So we collect about 100,000 particles for ATP-bound NSF. But suppose we collect another 50,000 particles, will that increase the resolution? I think that's something I try to learn from this workshop, or I hope I can draw your attention to think about it. So how much is enough? This is something I think worth thinking about. Data processing, so Yifan said everything works well. You need 1 week to process the data. But I'm very bad at particle picking, actually. So it actually took me much longer than 1 week to process data. And the Shenping helped a lot to pick the particles. I'm very slow on it. But for crystallography, actually, we have the data reduction can be done concurrently. So when you're collecting data, actually, it can doing the data processing in the background. And then if you have the phase problem, if you have all the data set there, then probably it will take several hours. So here, X-ray is a little bit faster, but still, the data is different. This is reciprocal space spots. These are real space data. So, well, 1 week is acceptable. For model building, this is here I want to draw your attention again. So for model building, there are manual model building and automatic model building. Automatic model building in X-ray crystallography, we have some softwares, but they don't work very well at higher resolution. Higher, I mean, better than 3 angstrom. they don't work well at lower resolution. Lower resolution means worse than 3S. For cryo EM, I'm not aware of any automatic model building tools. For manual model building, for X-ray, most of crystallographers use this program called COOT. Some of them use O. This is another program. But we do have some methods to help low-resolution model building, because for X-ray, we have, for the crystallographers here, we know that we can introduce anomalous scatterers, those selenomethionines. So that will pretty much help you. The difference anomalous signal will help you to build a model to register the alpha helices or to register the chains. But, well, for cryo-EM model building, I would say the only thing you have is the map. And usually the map is the final map. So you can, well, you can sharpen the map at different B factors, but still, I think more tools are needed to build, especially for cryo-EM. Most of the data set will be worse than 3 angstrom. It's 3 angstrom, 4 angstrom, 5 angstrom-ish. Model building is going to be very difficult. And here, I do wish we have some better tools available. Cross-validation, X-ray, we all know that there are widely accepted standards using 5% or 10% of data, the free data. You never see it after you process the data. And then up to you refine the structure. Then you compare the R-work, the residue work, and the residue free to see whether your model is overfitted or not. For cryo-EM, we do have some consensus recently, I think. Several groups published papers, but the question is, we should probably standardize it a little bit more, and we should think about if we can have some better methods. So here is the model validation for the ATP bond NSF in my case. On the left, I already showed you this graph. You are seeing the Fourier shell correlation. The resolution is actually estimated from a corrected Fourier shell correlation curve. The blue curve is the Fourier shell correlation of the final model against the full map. So we added two independent maps together. This is the blue curve. We did use a reciprocal space refinement. So like many people do, introduce the cryo-EM model into an artificial unit cell and then refine it with geometry restraints in the reciprocal space. But this step actually, it's not standardized yet, I think, because how to choose the unit cell, right? Should you choose a smallest possible unit cell or somehow arbitrary size unit cell? In my case, I think you should choose the smallest possible unit cell. But by doing that, actually, you will see the R work and R free, actually, the values are worse than, will become worse than, like, if you're choosing a unit cell that's corresponding to your box size, your EM box size, I mean. So here is what we did for the validation. And I think these methods are published. So several groups have used this method. Basically, what we did is we have the final refined model. We perturb the coordinates about 0.1 angstrom. So that pretend that it's not refined. And then we refine it against the half of the map. This is the work map, so we've seen that. And then we calculate the Fourier shell correlation with the work map and with the green map, with the other half map. So the fact that these two curves, the orange and the green curve, they don't separate too much means the model is not overfitted. But again, like how much is overfitted? This needs to be worked out, I think, or at least there are other methods. People propose other methods, like omitting a whole resolution shell and then try to see how well the model predicted high resolution shell. And again, I think these are the things I want to draw your attention, think about it, hope to make this single particle cryo-EM better. Okay, so before I take questions, I'd like to introduce you all these people involved in this project. This is Axel Bronger, my postdoc advisor. Qiangjing and Daniel, Sandro, they are involved in purification and enzymatic test of these NSF. Yifan and Shenping, they are critical for this project. Otherwise, I'll still be optimizing crystals. Thank you. I'll stop here.